Welcome to Parents Perspective. Oh, dear. Wendy glanced out the window at the two neighbor children standing in the snow in the yard next door. What, Mom? Asked her 8-year-old son, Kurt, dragging his sled from the basement toward the back door. I don't think the new kids next door have ever seen snow before. They're just standing out there watching it come down, she mused. Huh? Kurt looked at her quizzically. Where are they from, anyway? I think from an island in the Caribbean. It might be nice if you gave them a turn on your sled. They've probably never seen one of those either, you know. Kurt pulled on his boots and his hat and mittens. Wonder what they think you can do with snow. Wendy heard the back door slam behind him. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about how new immigrants and their children adapt to life in America? And how can we be helpful? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has worked with and helped many people who have just arrived in the U.S. Marianne Datesman taught ESL, English as a Second Language, and administered programs for more than 30 years, last teaching at Georgetown University. One interesting experience she mentioned to us was setting up a program for the first Cambodian refugees coming to Bowling Green, Kentucky in 1980. With Joanne Crandall and Edward N. Carney, she wrote American Ways, An Introduction to American Culture, now in its third edition. She has a grown daughter and, as she says, thanks to her husband, a stepson and a stepdaughter, and 4 beautiful grandchildren. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Marianne.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
Now, in writing about American culture, what did you have in mind as culture?
Well, that was a big question, and we debated that quite a bit before we started. Some people, when you say culture, think of art, music, literature. Other people think of things like when a woman sits down, does she put her purse on the floor or keep it next to her on the chair? We decided to go for something a little more complicated, and that is the values and beliefs that Americans share.
That's a tough one. So what values did you deal with?
Actually, it was Edward Carney, who came up with this conceptual framework, and his background is American studies. So this was really a 3-way deal where I was doing ESL, and Jody Crandall does ESL, but she has a degree in sociolinguistics and cross-cultural communication. So she really brought the big cultural perspective to us. And then Ned had American studies, which he had taught for some time. So he came up with a framework of 6 basic values. They're a set of pairs of values. The first is reasons why people traditionally have come and still come to the United States. And then the second is the price that they pay for that, which has itself developed into a value. So the big one is individual freedom. People really still come for that, but the price for that is self-reliance. And the second one is equality of opportunity. And by that, we mean the chance to succeed, not that everybody should be equal, but that everybody has an equal chance. And the price for that is competition. And the third one is for the American dream, for the good life. And the price for that is hard work.
What is the book used for? Who uses the book? It seems like a textbook that people would use in a class. Is that
yes, right? Yes, that's right. It is. And it's marketed as a reader, and it's primarily marketed to college-level classes and junior college also, or community colleges, and occasionally high school, but not usually. But it's also been used for classes on culture or for orientation programs, and it's been picked up by the Peace Corps has used it. USIA has used it for visiting scholars to help understand, because it is unique in that it's the only ESL book that really looks at what are the values and why do we act the way that we do? What's behind that? So it's had an international market. It's been used all over the world. And we just recently learned that it's being used in the American embassies around the world to teach the people who are native employees in the embassy.
What do you think is the biggest misconception immigrants have about United States culture?
Well, I think it probably depends on where they're coming from. But in terms of general misconceptions, I think that they have often a false picture of what Americans are like from American TV. American TV programs are all over the world. I mean, little towns way out in the countryside all over. So if you're watching Desperate Housewives, you're going to have perhaps a faulty picture of what neighborhood interaction is like, for example, and what the people are like as well. The other thing is how long it really takes to learn English. I think that a lot of people are not prepared for that.
Are the misconceptions different among children and teenagers?
Wrestling with freedom, because teens in the United States have so much more freedom than many teens in other countries. If a family's already here, they've laid the groundwork for the family. So for a teenager or a child to come at that point, they come into a fairly stable situation. But there's a lot of kids that come by themselves. I have a friend who was teaching in a high school, and she was teaching art. So she tended to get a lot of the students because they could go into those classes and not have a language issue. And she said she could always tell the ones that were there by themselves because they had these big backpacks. They had everything that they owned in the backpack because they often were going from house to house. And these are teenagers that are sent to get some education or to try to get a job. So it's surprising, but there's a number of these children around.
Do you think that the teens coming from other countries whose parents can't sit on them all the time because they're obviously out working very hard to support them, abuse the privilege of freedom here?
I think some do. There have been some problems with gangs from different countries because they naturally are looking toward a group, creating a family structure in that way. But then we have native-born Americans who are doing the same things, latchkey children. So probably a lot of them are, in general, more family-oriented. For example, having dinner together at night is very important to many cultures. So when they come to the United States, teenagers are expected to come home and have dinner. And I have heard students of mine in college who have been through this talking about it, and they said, I really resented the fact that I had to be home when my father came home from work and sit down with everybody and have dinner because I didn't get to go to something with my friends. She said, but now that I'm older, I realize the value in that, and I think that I will probably do the same thing. And that's another misconception, too, I think, that family isn't important to Americans, but it really is. It just maybe looks a little different.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on adapting to American culture.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Mary Ann Datesman about how immigrants adapt to American culture. What do you feel are the most important things that newcomers, and especially children, should know about culture in the U.S.?
One is touching, and this is not done so much now. I think a lot of elementary school teachers are much less prone to touch children than they were. But back when I was first dealing with refugee children, the issue of patting a child on top of the head came up. And in some cultures, you do not touch a child's head. That is really extremely disrespectful and offensive to do that. The other thing is eye contact. Eye contact is different in different cultures. And many cultures, a sign of respect for a child, if the teacher is trying to communicate something, will say, look me in the eye. For the child, that can go exactly the opposite of what they're taught, that to be respectful, you do not look the person of respect in the eye. You look down. So here's the child doing the respectful thing, looking at the floor, and the teacher frustrated because the child isn't looking at him or her. So that's an issue. In general, too, the school system in the United States is pretty complicated. And many parents don't realize that the American school system expects them to be involved in the education of their children. And so for many of them, they think, well, they're the teachers, they're the experts, so what do I know? So I'm not supposed to do this. So that's a big issue. And I would encourage parents to approach the school and ask, how can I be involved? What do I need to learn? But these often are not the ways that people are used to.
What other kinds of challenges do new immigrants and their children have to face in the U.S. in the 21st century?
They really face the same challenges as we do in the country, because we're kind of all in this together. Of course, right now, the issue of whether somebody is here legally or not is a big issue. And sometimes you'll find that the parents have come without a visa and the child has been born here. And so the child is a citizen and the parents are not. Maybe one parent is and the other one isn't. And a lot of people live in terrible fear of being discovered and their families being ripped apart. So it's a very complicated issue now. The other thing, of course, is I think concerns about will they be welcome, and if they're Muslims, for example, will they be profiled because they're covering their heads? So there's a lot of issues like that.
How can and should native-born Americans assist newcomers and their children to becoming more acculturated to our society?
It's a strength of our country. We are a nation of immigrants, and it's a strength that we have this diversity. But we need to really embrace it. The other day I was talking with a cab driver from Bangladesh, and I was asking him about how he was accepted and what his life was like. And he said that he lived in an apartment complex where he and his family were the only non-native people there, which is kind of surprising, especially in certain areas. Anyway, he said that Americans were always polite to him. They said hello, but he didn't really have a concept of what their daily lives were like, because they would come home, say hello in the elevator, then go into their apartment, and that's it. So he never got invited to their house. He never got to know them as individuals. And I think that's more a function of the fact of the pace of life that we have and the busyness that we have. And so here we are. So he wondered if they had friends or family, but he just doesn't know what their lives are like. And family is very important to us, and friends are very important to us. But we tend to have our little universe of our friends, our family, our work, perhaps our church, maybe some community stuff. But we don't often think about reaching out to strangers, including strangers from different cultures. I used to live in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I was back there a couple weeks ago, and they were having an international festival, and they had 3,000 people. This is a little town in Kentucky, but they had music and food and clowns, and it was very family-oriented. But I've also been to schools that have regular focus on international events, schools that have potlucks with international food and people dress up in their native costumes. So there's a lot of things that can be done if we just look for the opportunity and make the effort. Try to find a vehicle for reaching out, whether it's through the community or through the schools, volunteer programs. And it's a wonderful thing for our children, because we have the chance for our children to learn firsthand about other countries.
And I guess we all need to think back to remember that our own families, in most cases, came here as strangers. My father-in-law came here and spoke no English at all. He was 16 years old.
Really?
And the school system put him in second grade.
Oh, yeah.
So he had a terrible time. First of all, he didn't fit in the desk, much less fit in with the social activities of the second graders. But he was highly motivated to learn English and get into high school. And so I guess there were some positive things about that. But he never forgot that he came here knowing no one, unable to converse with him, unable to read even a street sign.
Yeah.
It was a tough thing.
I bet there are a lot of stories that you have heard over the years of people trying to become acclimated and how that's worked.
Yeah, you mentioned snow in your story at the beginning. I immediately thought about this college student from Morocco who was walking with me to class one day, and it started snowing, and it was snowing pretty big flakes. So we're walking along. I said, "Wow, it's really snowing big flakes." And she said, "Oh, I'm so excited because I've never seen snow before." But then she said, "But when do the really big ones come down?" I said, "What do you mean?" And she held out her hands about 3 feet, you know, around like this. And I said, "They never get that big. What makes you think that?" She said, "Well, the ground's covered with snow. I've seen pictures of it covered with snow. How can it be covered with snow with just these teeny little flakes?"
Good question.
I thought that was
an interesting perception.
Another story is about touching. We had a Japanese student who lived with us for several years. And when he came, he didn't speak any English at all. And my daughter and her friend, she was about 11 at the time, had fun teaching him interesting words, the kind of words that 11-year-olds like. And we're a very touchy-feely family, and so we were hugging him. And Japanese don't hug. It kind of made him uncomfortable at first, but then he got used to it. And so he went home the following summer. He said, "I'm going to hug my mother." So he went to the airport, and he said he put his arms around his mother, and she stood there with her arms down at her sides, and she said, "What are you doing?" And so he explained hugging and so forth. Well, we visited them a couple years later, and we got there, and she gave us this big hug. And so, we said, "Oh, well, we're kind of surprised." She said, "Oh, no, you know, now that she knew about hugging, she had been hugging all of her friends." So there's this hugging culture that had gone on in Japan. It's really
funny. Social movement.
Yeah, right.
What are some positive things you think we could learn from immigrant cultures about the way we deal with children and child rearing?
It depends on the culture, but I think that a lot of times you see children that are very respectful, perhaps more disciplined. I think the family is very important. I think the responsibility to the family. I remember one time visiting a student of mine from Iran, and I went to Iran, and he had finished his doctorate, and he was looking for a teaching position, and he said, "I have to consult with my older brother and the rest of my family about what position I take." And I said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Well, because I have to do what's in the best interest of the family." I was really surprised. I mean, here this man is a PhD, he's looking for a university position. So I think sometimes we can learn maybe about family and relationships. Another thing I think is, generally speaking, students from other countries have much more respect for teachers than American children do. Teachers are held in high esteem in their cultures. And as you look at television, and sometimes you see father is an idiot on television shows, and I think that does a disservice to parents and family. And you were mentioning about your father-in-law not speaking English when he first came. I think that might be the reason why in the United States children maybe have more freedom traditionally and have more independence, because they're the ones that learned English first. They're the ones who were out translating for their parents. Secondly, in the United States, we don't have a uniform way of looking at discipline. There's no consensus about how to discipline and what the behavior of children should be. And in many other cultures, there is a consensus. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it a little tougher for us.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on adapting to American culture.
For an audio CD of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Mary Ann Datesman about how immigrants adapt to American culture.
What is the general pattern that you've noticed after studying this of immigrant adaptation to American culture? Does it seem to differ for adults and kids? I know you mentioned, for example, the very consistent pattern of when a family comes over, the kids are the translators because they can absorb the language first. Have you noticed anything else?
I think it would make a difference between immigrants and refugees, because the refugees come for protection from some situation at home and generally come thinking that they're going to go back after a time, whereas immigrants are making the commitment that they're going to come. So I think that they face different challenges. It's easiest for the preteens to learn English. Once you hit puberty, your brain chemistry changes. It's much harder to learn a language. Children don't automatically learn. Some do, but some don't, and they really do need the instruction. Generally speaking, it takes three generations for a family to be completely Americanized. So the first generation, their native language is their language of origin. They learn English, maybe with a heavy accent, and some learn it better than others and so forth. Their children are in school, and they're generally bilingual. Their children generally don't speak the original language. By that time, it's lost. So by the third generation, you don't see very much difference at all. The other thing is about learning languages. There is this misconception that some groups don't want to learn English. And studies show that's really not the case. That a lot of these people who people are criticizing for not knowing English are working two jobs. They're working as maids or housekeepers or something during the day, and then at night they're cleaning offices. They're working with other crews that are speaking the same language. They don't have time to get to English. But if you look at the studies, they show that 96% of the people say English is important and we need to learn English.
Are there English-speaking courses by localities? In other words, who's responsible for helping immigrants learn to speak English?
No, it's a local thing. The adult education programs in the communities, the schools, adult ed programs. And that really is the big resource to turn to. There are programs that they offer for very low cost, and most of them are in the evening, although there are some day programs. And in some areas, there are waiting lists. Community colleges also will help people. Many of the students who come out of the high schools have some English, but it's not ready for university. They go to a community college. There are usually classes there that will help them bridge that gap. The estimates are that it takes a kid about 5 years to be able to have enough language to compete with a native speaker on an equal footing.
Is this because English is so complicated or because our language is in such flux?
It takes a long time to really get fluent with a language. I can remember my own daughter went to Spain to learn Spanish, and she reported to us that she was speaking caveman Spanish.
Complete with grunts.
Yes, right. And she was in an intensive language program, and then it took her a couple more years before she really felt like she didn't have to think about it. There's a big controversy now about how to educate non-native speakers of English in the schools. How much time should they be just put into the classroom, sink or swim, or with some support? And how much time should they be pulled out with intensive language training? You can learn a language fairly well in a year of intensive study.
Marianne, in addition to your book, American Ways, An Introduction to American Culture and Adult Ed and Community College Programming, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue some of the issues we've been talking about?
Well, we have a website, www.theamericanways.net, and on there we have a video and a couple of audio things where you have the transcript. The main resource that I would recommend is the Center for Applied Linguistics. The website is www.calcal.org. And there is also a telephone number, and that is 202-362-0700. And that's their main number. So when you call, ask for the bookstore. So you can go online and look at what their offerings are. Something else I'd like to mention is the Pluralism Project at Harvard University. And it's at pluralism.org. The Pluralism Project is studying religious diversity in the United States. I'd like to mention the Pew Research Center, PEW, pewresearchcenter.org, Brookings Institution at brookings.edu also has immigration studies and so forth.
That's a think tank.
I think the schools are probably the best resource for people in a community. Churches often have these things.
You know, there's a joke about, I think, Columbus arriving on American shores and the Indians standing there with a big sign that says illegal immigration.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, Mary Ann Datesman, you have given us so much information, so much to think about, so many resources for us to look into. So thank you so very much for coming to talk to us about a very, very important issue in the United States.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Mary Ann Datesman's book, American Ways, An Introduction to American Culture. Please call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 352 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.